I remember some time ago I watched the film Elizabeth about how Queen Elizabeth I ascended the throne, faced political resistance, and a turbulent geopolitical scene. And there's a scene where Elizabeth is by herself and looks up to a painting of her father, Henry VIII. She realizes her power and her lineage and boldly proclaims, "I am my father's daughter. What can man do to me?" That story was brought to mind when I was preparing this message about a woman who would become queen under unlikely circumstances. And this woman would have an even bigger calling, not merely to support the king, but to become the savior of her people, the Jews. We're looking today at the story of Esther, part of our series on the story, the Bible as one continuous story of God and God's people. A few weeks ago, we looked at the group of exiles that had returned to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. God was with them and upheld his covenant with them. Despite their sin and disobedience, God returned many to their homeland, people who were starting over and beginning again. Many of the Jews returned to their homeland, but as we said, some also stayed and settled in their new land. And today we're looking at the story of Esther, a famous story in both Jewish and Christian tradition. A story about a brave young woman whom God called to rescue his people from those who wished to annihilate them. Esther is a remarkable story of God's deliverance of his people despite enemies that wished to wipe them out. It is a story of ultimate ironic reversal, an exciting drama where the tables get turned and the Lord's plans prevail in the end. So let's look at the story of Esther and what it might have to say to us today. The story of Esther begins with King Ahasuerus, who's also called Xerxes in some translations. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew rendering of the term mighty man, a name he used for himself. He was emperor or king. Ahasuerus is king of Persia with his wife, Queen Vashti. At a banquet, King Ahasuerus wanted Queen Vashti to appear before them and his court to admire her beauty while wearing her royal crown and probably very little else. Vashti, not wanting to prance around as an object for the enjoyment of the king and his officials, refused his request. So the king became angry and deposed Vashti. And the king then begins a search for a new queen and hosts a 5th century BC version of The Bachelor, King of Persia edition, to find her. All the eligible, attractive young women were brought to the king and given head-to-toe makeovers to make them as appealing as possible for the king. And one of the young women was a Jewish girl named Esther, raised by her cousin Mordecai in the tribe of Benjamin, who had adopted her as his own daughter when her parents passed away. Mordecai told Esther to conceal her identity as a Jew from the king, and she followed his advice. She underwent all the beauty treatments and was presented to the king. And the king was pleased with her and took her to be his new queen in place of Vashti. He gave her a royal crown and lavished many gifts upon her. After Esther was made queen, King Ahasuerus appointed a man named Haman as his second in command over the kingdom. Now, why is this significant? Well, because Haman was a guy with a giant chip on his shoulder who had an axe to grind with the Jewish people. And this was a bad combination. Now, why was Haman like this? Well, Haman was an Agagite. Agagites were descended from King Agag, former king of the Amalekites. The who now? The Amalekites. Now, who were they? Well, if you remember back further in the story, way back in the earlier chapters when God first gave Israel a king, King Saul, who ended up not being the best of kings, to say the least. He disobeyed God and was eventually replaced by King David. But at one point, while Saul was still king, God commanded him to wipe out the Amalekites. But Saul merely defeated them, allowing many of them to survive, including their king, King Agag, 1 Samuel 15:20. And the line of the Amalekites continued, including Agag's line, and Haman is a direct descendant, it's believed, of this king, Agag. So Haman didn't like the Jews, to say the least. So So when Haman assumes his position of authority as king, he immediately orders all the people to bow down to him and pay homage at the king's command. It seems like we see this recurring theme of despotic leaders demanding this kind of reverence and obeisance. However, Mordecai did not bow down to Haman. Haman, of course, didn't take this well. He not only hated the Jews, but he particularly hated Mordecai. And in response to Mordecai's lack of obedience, Haman persuaded the king to pass an edict in which all those of Jewish descent were to be destroyed on a particular day of a particular month. And to determine this day, Haman cast pur, which means dice. So they literally cast lots or rolled dice to determine the month on the calendar, the day that would be for the Hebrews' destruction. The lot fell to the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, about this time of year on our modern calendar. And when word of the edict reached Mordecai, he was greatly distressed. He donned sackcloth and ashes and began mourning and wailing. And Mordecai told Queen Esther, who was also distressed. He persuaded Esther to go to the king and plead for her people. Now, Esther knew that anyone who approached the king without being summoned would be put to death, and she had not been summoned in over a month. If Esther went to the king without being summoned, she could be executed. Only if the king held out his golden scepter to her would she be spared. When she told Mordecai this, he replied, chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father and family will perish. Who knows, perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this." Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went and did everything as Esther ordered him. So after this, Esther approached the king. I'm sure she was nervous, to say the least. And the king held out his golden scepter to her, indicating his favor toward her. He asked her to make a request up to half of his kingdom. She requested in the king's presence, along with Haman, that she, at a banquet she wanted to throw for them. And she said she would tell him his request at that time. So the king agreed, and he and Haman attended the banquet the next day. And while they were drinking, the king again asked Esther to make her request up to half the kingdom. She again invited the king and Haman to another banquet the next day, and at that time she would make her request. And again Haman and the king agreed to come. As Haman was returning home from being in the king's presence, he saw Mordecai at the gate. And Mordecai, as usual, did not bow down or honor Haman, and this infuriated him. Haman told his wife about the incident, and she told Haman to build a large gallows and have the king hang Mordecai on it. Haman liked this idea and went along with it. Meanwhile, the king was having trouble sleeping one night, so he ordered that the annals of his kingdom be read to help him sleep. Wouldn't that be nice if we were having trouble sleeping and someone could read the annals of your life, all the good things you had done to help you sleep? Well, the king heard of an account of how Mordecai had warned the king about a plot against his life. And the king wanted to honor Mordecai for saving his life. He summoned Haman and asked him how he should honor a man who had given so much to save the king's life. Haman, thinking the king was talking about himself, said the king should put on royal vestments to such an individual and lead him through the streets and on the king's horse to honor such an individual. So the king ordered Haman to do this for Mordecai. As you can imagine, Haman was less than thrilled about this order of the king. I mean, picture the scene. Here's Haman decking Mordecai out in royal vestments and putting him on the king's horse and riding him publicly through the kingdom to honor him. This was all done by Haman, the man who hated Mordecai the most. You can imagine how that stuck in his craw. Mordecai was honored while Haman was humiliated, and Haman was not going to let this rest. He was furious that the king would honor his enemy, Mordecai, a Jew. Haman attended Queen Esther's second banquet with the king the next day, and the king asked Esther to make her request. At that time, she did. She asked the king to spare her people who had been ordered to be destroyed. The king demanded to know who would order such a thing. When it was revealed that Haman had ordered it, the king had Haman hanged on the very gallows that were set up for Mordecai. Quite a reversal of fortune. Mordecai was given Haman's royal position and went forth in royal robes and a golden crown. Chapter 8:16 tells us, in every province, in every city, wherever the king's command and edict came, there was a gladness and joy among the Jews, a festival and a holiday. Furthermore, many of the people from the country came to profess to be Jews because the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. So what had happened to this royal edict that couldn't be changed, that caused this celebration? Well, the king, as many kings do, issued a new edict and amended the original one that would bring about the destruction of the Jews and revised the edict to say that on this particular day in question, the Jews were permitted to defend themselves and kill anyone who came against them. So when the fateful day came, the Jews defended themselves and killed all those who came against them. And the Jews were spared due to Queen Esther and her courage. The people celebrated with a great feast, which became a yearly tradition, the Feast of Purim, which Jews remember Queen Esther and how she saved the people from destruction. The word Purim comes from the word pur, which we said earlier means dice. Haman had rolled the dice to determine the day the Jews would be destroyed, and yet it was Haman and his fellow countrymen who went against the Jews who ended up being destroyed. The Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim to this day. In fact, the celebration is coming up later this month. On the Feast of Purim, Jews celebrate the defeat of Haman and the salvation of the Jewish people. The feast is celebrated with wine and other intoxicating beverages, and the Book of Esther is read to remind everyone of the story, and observers often send gifts and gifts of money to the poor on this day. It's a big day of celebration. And it's a feast commemorating God's deliverance of God's people. So what does Queen Esther's story have to say to us today? Well, Queen Esther's story, as we've said, is part of the lower story. That's part of God's bigger upper story, that overarching grand story of God's redemption of God's people throughout the whole of the story. Esther's lower story is part of that upper story redemption plan. God intervenes on behalf of his people, even in a foreign land, to redeem them from their enemies who seek to destroy them. God works through great monarchs, even foreign monarchs, as well as regular people like Esther and Mordecai, to accomplish God's purposes. Now, the curious thing about the book of Esther is that God's name is never directly mentioned. Some scholars in the past questioned whether Esther should even be included in the biblical canon for this reason. But the omission of God's name doesn't mean that God wasn't an active participant in the story. Though God is not mentioned, we see God's hand at work through all the twists and turns of the story. It's almost as if the omission of God's name actually punctuates his presence and his activity on behalf of his people. Though foreign kings may rule over God's people from time to time, God ultimately is their great king, in charge of their well-being and their preservation. And God works through regular individuals, just like Esther and Mordecai, to bring forward his purposes, as we've seen time and again in the story. In Esther, Jewish people are threatened, but God's promise is also threatened. His covenant with Abraham to make the Jews a great nation, remember that way back? Beginning of the story, that he was to bless them and make them a great nation, and yet here all of that is threatened. They're threatened to be wiped out. God's whole upper story plan is threatened to be wiped out. And also God's promise of the Messiah is threatened, for if there's no Jewish nation, there's no Messiah, no redemption of all humankind. Yet God and God's power acted on behalf of the people and rescued them and redeemed them. And God kept his promise, preserved the covenant, and is still at work in our world today, bringing about his purposes and redemption in Jesus Christ. There are no doubt many Hamans in our world today, those who seek to exploit and oppress and destroy other people and demand others groveling. We see them every night on the evening news and around the world. Maybe you even know a Haman-type person in your own life. Maybe not to that extreme, but we all know people who have destructive tendencies, who don't care about other people. But one thing we can take away from the book of Esther is that the Hamans of this world, for them, their days are numbered. The Hamans of this world will not have the final say. God will vindicate the suffering of his people and will put the world to right once and for all. We're in the season of Lent, a six-week period on the church calendar where we prepare for Easter. We observed Ash Wednesday this past week, a day when we are marked with ashes to signify our mortality, a day when we remember that we are dust, and to dust we shall return. Lent is a period that reminds us of our mortality, our fallenness, our sinful nature that rebels against God and lashes out at others who are made in God's image. Lent reminds us that we are not able to save ourselves, but that we need a Savior. Yet Lent is not all gloom and doom, for in Lent we remember God's love for us, God's grace for us who are fallen, God's desire to save us from sin and death once and for all. Death is not the end. It is not the final answer for humanity, for God promises redemption. By sending his own son, Jesus the Christ, to earth, God made a way for his ultimate upper story plan of redemption of all humanity to take place. Jesus, by suffering and dying on the cross, bore the full weight of human sinfulness and suffering, and in rising from the grave, triumphed over death itself. The resurrection was a vindication for Jesus and his suffering. Easter is the ultimate ironic reversal tale, the ultimate turning of the tables, the ultimate rolling of the dice in our favor. It is said that Jesus' resurrection at Easter is the greatest practical joke ever played on the devil. For Jesus' death looked like ultimate defeat and failure, yet it was God who had the last laugh over sin, death, and the devil. The story of Esther reminds us that God's plans will ultimately prevail over evil. Like Esther, we are called to stand up to the Hamans of the world and to follow God and trust in God's ways despite the cost. We are to show the courage that Esther did when she was called upon for such a time as this. So let us remember that God's promises never fail. No matter what power on earth comes against us, nothing can thwart God's ultimate purposes. May Esther's example strengthen our faith and give us courage and hope for our time, for such a time as this. And may God bless this message to our hearing. Amen.